Today, I will start with a reference to a discussion that we had in the last class. That is, that's something related to the very evolution of action or karma in our life. To understand the core of karma yoga, the psychology and the methodology of karma yoga, we need this analysis. Now, this analysis is based on the famous Vedantic classic Bhagavad Gita. Many of you may be familiar, but still I shall give an outline. Bhagavad Gita is an ancient classic written in Sanskrit language. It has 700 verses. Divided into 18 chapters. It is in the form of a dialogue between two great men of action. It is a tiny fraction of a bigger classic, which has more than 100,000 verses, Mahabharata, supposed to be the greatest, the largest literary work ever produced in human history, Mahabharata, more than 100,000 verses. Bhagavad Gita contains only 700 verses, a tiny fraction. To understand the huge size of Mahabharata, may I remind you, it is almost 11 times as big as Iliad and Odyssey put together, Homer's Greek classics, Iliad and Odyssey put together. It is 11 times as big as Iliad and Odyssey put together. Now, it's in the form of a dialogue between two friends. One was a great spiritual personality, the teacher, Lord Krishna, and his friend Arjuna, a warrior who was called upon to do a sacred duty to protect the women folk, the poor people, the weak people from the exploitations and cruelties of some evil-minded persons. Now, here at the very beginning, this man, Arjuna, the warrior, who was called upon to do his responsibility as a warrior, to protect the women folk, the poor people and the weak people from the evil men, he felt a little bit of nervous fear, embarrassment. He wanted to withdraw from his duty and responsibility. But he doesn't say that openly. Suddenly he becomes confused, perplexed, and then he says, well, I won't do this duty because fighting is evil. Now, if you are a policeman or a soldier who is on the payroll of the government and whose duty is to protect the country, the good people from thieves, robbers or foreign invasions, and if you say, well, I won't do my duty, it's a terrible sin. It is not non-violence. So this man suddenly was possessed by an impulse to withdraw from his duty and responsibility. So he approached his teacher, Lord Krishna. He did not directly tell him, well, I don't want to work. He said, what's the use of all these activities? I would rather become a mendicant. I would rather become a beggar. Even if I had to live as a beggar, that's better for me. I won't do my duty. I won't fight with these evil men. Now, his teacher was a great philosopher, Lord Krishna. He could see through the game which Arjuna was playing. Arjuna felt fear, But he concealed his cowardice and fear, and then he tried to give a philosophical justification for his lethargy, laziness, and inertia. Now, this is the most contemptible part of human character. If somebody feels an impulse to withdraw from his duty, to remain quiet, doing nothing, and then try to justify his inaction, that's the worst thing that anyone can do. And Krishna did not hesitate to call this man a hypocrite. A person who speaks the language of a mendicant, but who has not reached that level of non-attachment and renunciation, but speaks like a mendicant, like a Buddha or a Christ, but out of laziness and cowardice, that person is a hypocrite. That's what Lord Krishna says. So first, Krishna did not teach Arjuna the principles of Karma Yoga. What Krishna did was to teach him the principles of action with desire. Because it's better to do something with a strong desire, with a strong motive, than to do nothing and then pretend to be a great philosopher, to be a man of wisdom and renunciation. But mind full of confusion and perplexity, full of desires, but he's not willing to work out to fulfill his desires. Now, this is the most contemptible aspect of human character. So Krishna, as I said earlier, did not teach him Karma Yoga. Because a student is of a small boy who is asked to join school by his or her mother, says, "Well, I don't want to study." And then somehow, he must have heard from some sources that if you are studying in university, you don't have to study the alphabet. You don't, because you already know very well. But the child has to memorize the alphabet, study the alphabet. So it's a painstaking effort. So I would rather go and sit in the senior class. I would rather be a researcher. I would rather go and sit in the master's class than going to the primary school. Because if you join the master's class, you don't have to study the alphabet. But if you are in the primary class, you have to do that. Now the child will never make any progress in spiritual life. Because we have to start with where we stand, from where we stand, and slowly evolve. So from inaction, one should graduate, evolve, to the stage of action, with desire or without desire. From inaction and laziness and lethargy, one should evolve to the next stage of human evolution. What's that stage? The stage of action with desire. And then, but then as I said earlier, I already explained earlier, if a person is very efficient, full of motivation, full of desire, and very enthusiastic and obsessed with the results of his actions, naturally, it creates a lot of problems, anxiety, neurosis, depression, disappointment, and all kinds of problems, conflicts, inner conflicts with one's own mind, and outer conflicts with the rest of the world. And then, any amount of material gain won't give you permanent happiness. So this is the end result of action with desire. So there is a solution. So Krishna says, act with full enthusiasm, with full energy, motivation, and zeal, but be non-attached to the results of action. Because non-attachment takes away a huge psychological burden from our mind. But as I said earlier, it should not degenerate into complacency, negligence, or indifference. Now, here comes the relevance of yoga. Now, yoga can be said to be the next stage of human evolution. Now, we have reached a particular stage of human evolution. Evolution at the physical level. We cannot evolve further. Evolution at the psychological level, at the cultural level, at the spiritual level is still possible. So evolution is completed now. There is no further scope for any kind of evolution at the physical level. But there is a lot of scope for further evolution at the cultural level, at the spiritual level, at the psychological level. So yoga takes you to the next stage of evolution, which takes you to freedom. In fact, that is the real relevance of yoga. So once we have reached the stage of a very high level of efficiency, duty consciousness, and proficiency in action, and then still we find that when we find that there is not permanent happiness, then we have to think, what is there wanting in human character? What stands in the way of attaining permanent happiness? So at that stage we evolve, we start evolving to the next stage of human evolution. We can say this is the evolution at the level of values, culture, thinking, and so on, and ultimately spirituality. This is possible only for human beings. If you look at the animal kingdom, they also have evolved a very high level of efficiency. You look at the ants, for example. The way they organize their towns, maybe at their level, they are masters of town planning. See honeybees, how they construct their nests. Even small birds bringing different things from all over nature, and they construct small nests to protect their small ones. So the most classical example is the world of ants and the world of honeybees, perhaps. Very high level of efficiency, organization, planning, and team spirit you can find among these beings. Now, if you judge what they achieve in terms of their size, I think they are at a far higher level of civilizational evolution, scientific and technological evolution, than human beings, perhaps. You have to take into consideration their size and what they achieve. Now, but these creatures cannot evolve beyond that limits. As I said earlier, the one line of demarcation between the animal kingdom and human beings is this. Human beings can stop, pause for a minute, and think, well, what am I doing? Where am I coming from? Where am I heading for? What's the meaning of life? What's the meaning of existence? And how can we achieve permanent peace and happiness, harmony and synthesis? This is the line of demarcation between the animal kingdom and human beings. At this stage, human beings start evolving to the next stage of spiritual freedom. And mind you, cultural freedom, psychological freedom, all these different aspects of freedom become realities when you achieve spiritual freedom. I can illustrate this in the light of a famous Sanskrit verse from a great classic on Vedanta by Shankaracharya, who lived between 778 BC and 810.
32 years. The name of the work is Viveka Chudamani. The verse is this, I shall explain in English. Shabdadibhi panjabhireva panja, panjattu mapusa gunena baddhaha, kuranga madanga padanga meenaha, bhanga nara panjabhiranchitakim. The translation is illuminating, in fact. Here, the author, the great poet, philosopher, takes the example of five creatures from nature and tells us how they get trapped, caught in the nest of death. First, he says, deer. Now, in ancient times, hunters used to kill deers. They used to play flutes. And listening to this music, the deers will listen to this music with great concentration and they will stand still. Or if they are hiding in a cave or in a bush, they will come out. At that time, the hunter will shoot an arrow and the deer will be killed. Now the poet says that deer is caught because of his attraction towards something that is sound. So its mind was dragged by its ears to the place from where the sound was coming and it meets its death. So one of the senses becomes the cause of its destruction. At the end of the verse, you can see how the great philosopher, the poet, great philosopher poet, takes gives a philosophical analysis of the plight of human beings. Now, the next creature, next example is the example of elephants. Now, elephants, they move in herds, in families. Tiny baby elephants will be under the protection of their parents. They touch each other. So, the sense of touch becomes the cause of their destruction. Because as they move, touching each other, they fall in a pit. So normally, those who catch elephants will dig a huge pit and will cover it with bush and grass. And elephants moving in herds, touching each other, will fall in the pit. And then they may be enslaved, sometimes they will be killed. This also happens. So the sense of hearing becomes the cause of its death. It loses its freedom. The sense of touch. The sense of hearing becomes the cause of destruction for the deer. And the sense of touch becomes the cause of death for the elephant. Now the next example taken is moths. During rainy season, moth. M-O-T-H, moth. During the rainy season, a large number of insects sometimes emerge from the earth. And then people sometimes, maybe the tropical countries, they start small fires. So these moths will be attracted, drawn towards the blazing fire. They think this is something very fun, very interesting, very attractive. And as they fly towards this blazing fire, they will burn to ashes. So they are killed. So that the sense of vision becomes the cause of their destruction. Now, the fourth example is fish. Now, fishermen put a piece of meat or something as on the hook, and attracted by the taste of, or maybe the smell, mostly taste of this bite, the fish will be caught and it loses its freedom. It becomes the cause of its bondage. The fifth example is black bees. They will be moving in the garden from flower to flower, flower plant to flower plant, and they will be caught attracted by the perfume, the smell of the flowers, they lose their freedom, they are killed. And as they move from flower plants to flower plants, they may be caught and may be killed. Now, at the end of this verse, Shankaracharya asked the question, what is the plight, what is the pathetic condition of human beings? See, human beings are simultaneously being dragged to all these objects. See, when we live normally, our mind is being drawn, attracted, being drawn towards the object of vision, and our ears are drawn towards the object of towards something which produces noise, and when we touch something, the sense of touch also drags the mind towards it, and when we smell something, mind will be dragged by this touch of, by the sense of smell, and also when we taste. So in the case of human beings, all these five senses simultaneously drag human mind towards different objects. So how to get freedom from the clutches of the senses? Freedom given to the senses is spiritual slavery, but freedom from the senses is spiritual freedom. If you give full freedom to your senses, it means spiritual slavery. But if you try to get freedom from the clutches, from the tyranny of senses, it means spiritual freedom. So, the great philosophers evolved a strategy, a psychological strategy. You live in the world, but don't be part of this world. Live in the world, but mind should be kept in a state of complete equilibrium, equanimity, through the mechanism of, psychological mechanism of non-attachment. This is the, now this is possible only for human beings. In fact, it is this non-attachment which is the first stage in the path of karma yoga. Through non-attachment, we are able to combine efficiency on the one hand, contemplation on the other. Intense action, intense efficiency, enthusiasm, and all the benefits of well-directed workaholism, not blind workaholism. Well-directed efficiency, psychological, mental, intellectual, and physical efficiency. But along with that, an understanding of the limitations of the fruits of efficiency. You can have the best of the world, but remember, the best of the world is not good enough. You can have the best of material benefits in the world, but within the mind, we have to remember that the best that the material world can bring to you is not good enough, because it cannot be everlasting. So in ancient times, the ideal of a famous ideal, you find this here, of combining action with contemplation was evolved. See, it's called the Rajarshi ideal. You know, Rajarshi is a Sanskrit word. Raja means king, administrator, and symbolic of efficiency, action, enthusiasm, zeal, organization, leadership skills, science, technology, material prosperity, everything. All these are implied in that particular word, king. Raja. Rishi means sage. So can one be a king in action and a sage in contemplation? Can one combine action and contemplation? This is the clue to karma yoga. So if one can keep himself busy or herself busy in action, in intense action, with great efficiency, enthusiasm, and organization skill, enjoying the best of the world, but with a proper understanding of the real fact that the best of the world cannot bring you eternal peace and happiness. Then it can be called the Rajarshi ideal. In Sanskrit, it means Rajarshi, it means Rajanascha Rishayascha Rajarshayaha. There is a famous interpretation to this ideal, and that is very, very, very vital and very significant. So I shall quote this. So a great commentator of this ideal, which is expounded in the Gita by Lord Krishna, says that the word king indicates material prosperity, and all that comes along with that, and all that are necessary for material prosperity, like efficiency, enthusiasm, science, technology, everything. And Rishi, I mean the sage, that word represents the efficiency or the wisdom to understand the limitations of all that you can achieve through work and through efficiency. So if one can combine the best of science and technology, the best of the so-called Western Greco-Roman culture and civilization, and the spiritual heritage of a Buddha or a Krishna or a Ramakrishna Paramahamsa or a Vivekananda or a Confucius or a Jesus Christ, if one can combine together, that is the ideal of Karma Yoga in practical terms. Because if we can have only work, well, you can easily imagine, work as we understand today, the ideal of the cult of efficiency that we understand today is, historically speaking, is the legacy of Greco-Roman tradition, later further enriched and evolved during the post-industrial revolution period through the tools of science and technology. They are necessary, they are needed for eradicating poverty, for advancing material life, for spreading education, for communication, transportation, for all these things. But at the same time, without the spiritual wisdom behind, which teaches us to make proper use of the fruits of science and technology, work alone is a lopsided ideal. This is the central teachings of Gita. Therefore, you find in Vedantic tradition, they have evolved four fundamental values in our daily life. Four values. There are two guiding values and there are two instrumental values. Guiding values, which is called dharma, as is understood in Hindu tradition, in Buddhist tradition, and also Jaina tradition. Righteousness, discipline, morality, ethics, practiced in interhuman relationships. All these ideas are implied by the word dharma. This is one of the guiding values. The ultimate guiding value is moksha or liberation, as we call it, freedom from bondage. Now, as anyone can see, these two values are not enough for human life. But there are two other values which may be called instrumental values. They are called artha and kama. Means the instruments, the tools that we need for fulfilling our material desires. All these are included. So money, status, the good things of this world, all these are necessary, but necessary, they are necessary, but they cannot be the ultimate values of human existence. Any society, individual, nation which tries to achieve material prosperity through science and technology without upholding the values of righteousness implied by the word dharma cannot ultimately enjoy peace and happiness. So, when you reach a particular stage in material prosperity, you start thinking of what lies beyond. Efficiency and hard work are suspended and intuition takes its place. Suddenly we feel a kind of divine discontentment, a felt need for going beyond the present, beyond the empirical, beyond the phenomenal. So that is the beginning of evolution, the higher evolution in values, which is the essence of yoga. So as I said, yoga implies the higher evolution, evolution in values. When we have already completed evolution at the material plane, another stage of evolution begins, and that evolution is evolution at the spiritual plane. So this evolution ultimately takes us to spiritual freedom, and the path is sometimes called karma yoga. Another term which is often used is practical Vedanta. See, very often you find Vedanta philosophy, whenever we talk about higher spirituality, one very common question that is raised is it really practical for us living in this world? Can Vedanta or metaphysics be really practical? That question arises. So, to answer this question, the ancient sages have accommodated all these four values: the realities of everyday life, the needs of material life, our duties and responsibilities related to our daily existence are accommodated. But along with that, we are also reminded of the fact that there is something beyond duty, beyond material prosperity, beyond all that we can achieve through efficiency and hard work. And that is freedom. Freedom from the lower values, freedom from the lower mind, freedom from the lower instincts, freedom from obsession with material gains, freedom from the clutches of the senses, from the tyranny of the senses. And this freedom can be achieved only through this psychological mechanism which is called yoga. And in the context of karma yoga, this yoga takes the form of complete non-attachment towards the work we are doing. How can we be completely non-attached? So, in karma yoga, on the one hand we have karma, on the other hand we have yoga. How do we really practice yoga? How to practice non-attachment? For that, at the beginning, one should remember that we are something more than this body, more than this mind, more than this intellect. And we are something which goes beyond all this. We are consciousness. And consciousness is devoid of any kind of actions, results, or anything. Consciousness is Atman. It is universal. It is all-pervading. It is immanent. It is transcendental. So, duties, actions, responsibilities, all these are necessary. But they do not in any way affect consciousness or Atman. And we are in reality that Atman. Then what about action? Action is necessary. Results are necessary. but we should not be attached to the results or the actions which produce the results. So this combination, that is, on the one hand, intense action, on the other hand, intense freedom from the obsession of results, obsession with the results of action. Can we be active and at the same time free from the obsession with the result? Now, this is possible by combining, by synthesizing action with non-attachment. So, this is explained in one of the Upanishadic texts, in the first minor Upanishad is called. The sloka is this: Isha vasyam idam sarvam yat kincha jagatyam jagat tena tyaktena munchitaha ma gridakasya siddhanam kurvaneva karmani jijivisheshatam samaha evam suina anyade dosti na karma lipyate nare. This is verse. I should explain in English. The Sanskrit verse may sound a bit strange to you, but I should explain in English language. The first part of this mantra tells us this world is pervaded by the divine spirit. That's the first part of mantra. Means the entire creation, the entire universe is an expression of the divine spirit. That is the highest spiritual ideal, metaphysical ideal. Now, the next part of the verse tells us, therefore, live in this world. If the entire world is an expression of the divine spirit, is pervaded by the divine spirit, then how do we live in this world? Live in this world, enjoy this world, enjoy through the medium of renunciation. This is the language used in the ancient classic. Enjoy through the medium of renunciation. If you enjoy through enjoyment, you are caught. As the fish is caught by the bite, the deer is caught by the sound, or the elephant is caught by the sense of touch, or the moth by the sense of vision. So, if you live in this world and try to enjoy the world through enjoyment, then we are caught. But if you can enjoy through the medium of renunciation, through non-attachment, then you are not caught. So we can go on working. We can actively remain engaged in our duties and responsibilities. But if you are attached, you are caught. Attachment is a chain. Sometimes it could be a golden chain. If you are attached to something which is pleasant, which brings us a pleasant feeling, we become enamored of it. That also is a chain, maybe golden chain. And golden chain is as effective in blocking your freedom as iron chain. So, this ancient classical work tells us that we can live in this world, enjoy this world, work in this world, but we can live and work and enjoy this world not through the medium of enjoyment, not through the medium of attachment, but which brings us to bondage, but through the medium of non-attachment. Whatever work we are doing, even in inter-human relationships, family relationship, all this we can do. Everything, all duties we must do, responsibilities we must do. But if we can remain ourselves spiritually free through this psychological mechanism of non-attachment, then we can enjoy. One need not run away from the world. One need not go to a forest or a hermitage. One can live in the midst of this world, but still practice renunciation. That is the essence of practical Vedanta. Vedanta actually means supreme knowledge, renunciation, spiritual experience. All these ideas are implied in Vedanta, by the word Vedanta. But at the same time, for leading a life based on Vedantic principles, one need not run away from this world. One can live in the middle of the world, in the world of intense activity, but still combine that activity with contemplation. Contemplation gives us a feeling of mental equilibrium, because contemplation brings the ideal of non-attachment, and non-attachment gives a feeling of peace and tranquility, and that gives us a feeling of equilibrium. On the other hand, attachment suddenly brings anxiety, disturbance, and also a feeling of being bound to this world. So this is one aspect. The second part, in the second verse, this Upanishad tells us that mantra is kurvanneva iha karmani jiji visheshatam samah. The meaning is this: you live in this world, be active. 100 years you can live, but be active, keeping in mind that you are the Atman, you are the consciousness which is not bound or involved in any kind of action, which is the all-pervading reality, all-pervading supreme reality. And this feeling and this conviction helps us to remain non-attached. A question which naturally may arise to anyone: how can we have a beginning? How can we, where do we start? The question may arise. The idea is this: even an intellectual understanding, even a rational thinking, will give us an idea of the transitoriness of empirical objects, which we may attain through action. So the feeling of that, the conviction that whatever the world can offer is transitory, it is not everlasting, gives us the feeling that we should go beyond this. Therefore, in Vedantic tradition, the first discipline for any student of yoga or Vedanta is this: a strong sense of discrimination, means wisdom or discerning mind, to distinguish between the real and unreal. What is called nitya anitya vastu viveka. Nitya means eternal, that which never perishes. When you gain something, when you attain something and you feel, well, you have attained, that feeling comes. It is not satisfaction. Anything that you attain in this world through hard work may give you a sense of satisfaction, but next day it will vanish, you may lose it. So it's not permanent, it's not a permanent state of mind. But if you get something which is really eternal, spiritually rewarding, you feel, well, I have gained something. Beyond this, there is nothing that I should seek. This conviction. Now, to achieve this, we must have a discerning mind. What is real? What is unreal? Now, there are different levels of reality. But at the higher level, you can include everything other than spiritual freedom under the category of the unreal. Anything that doesn't give you spiritual freedom is unreal. Anything that keeps you within a state of bondage, maybe you may be bound by a golden chain, it is unreal. And anything which gives you a feeling of freedom is real. Therefore, this is the first discipline that is needed for any student of yoga and Vedanta. The That's why in relation to this, I must refer to the two well-known disciplines in the Ashtanga Yoga, that is, which are technically known as Yama and Niyama. As I mentioned this briefly in the first class, that the two sets of disciplines, five disciplines under the category of Yama, which are general, and five disciplines under the category of Niyama, which are specific. As I said, you know, Ahimsa, non-violence. So whatever we may achieve in this world, whatever gives you more vigor and strength and ability to work will help you to achieve something. But before we get this extra energy and power, we must discipline our mind. And the first discipline mentioned is Ahimsa. Ahimsa is not just non-violence, it is essentially a philosophy of life. The feeling of absolute non-aggression, absolute non-aggrandizement, non-violence towards ourselves and towards the entire world. This takes away a huge psychological burden from our mind, because a person who is fully established in the Ahimsa or non-violence ideal cannot see anybody in the world as his enemy, cannot see anybody or anything as a stranger. That is why in the presence of great saints and sages, people generally cannot do anything evil or violent. Because the personality of the person of that individual who is established in non-violence ideal silently influences all around him, and they become spiritually influenced, they naturally become non-violent. So the first one is non-violence, non-aggrandizement, a sense of complete satisfaction and a feeling of non-distinction with the entire world. This is the first one. The second one is truthfulness. These are all interrelated. A person who is naturally established in non-violence will be truthful. Now, one may very often ask this question. All these values are essentially individualistic values. Non-violence, not for a nation or a society, but for an individual. Now, spiritual life is basically a matter of individual growth. Evolution takes place at the individual level. When a large majority of people get established in the spiritual ideals, society also may be said to be spiritually evolved. But evolution takes place not at the level of individual, society, organization or nation, but the individual level. So, as I said, the first discipline is a strong sense of discerning wisdom, the ability to distinguish between what is real and what is unreal. Generally, we mistake the unreal for the real and get attached towards that. And it is this misunderstanding, mistaking the unreal for the real, that really makes us obsessed with the unreal things. And that creates greed, that makes us violent, and that takes us away from the fundamental disciplines. So, the first discipline is mentioned, non-violence. I think today we have already reached the end of the lecture, and we have got about 30 minutes. So, you can ask any question related to the subjects that we have discussed on previous occasions and also today. So, during the interaction, I will try to give some other ideas related to the subject. Any discussion, something you can. Please.
Swamiji, the question comes about the fact that, okay, for spiritual freedom, we go to ahimsa, we go to satya, and then we don't want attachment, we want to have little attachment, or through discrimination to figure out what is unreal, real. But again, you know, the mind is such, and we are a tyranny of the senses, and at times you need passion to move forward, so you need attachment. If you don't have passion, you're not going to achieve. That's one aspect. And then...
May I ask this question first?
Sure.
Because, yeah, then we can... Now, we need a kind of involvement, application, complete identification with the work we are doing, with the goal that we are trying to achieve. True. At this stage, at the third stage I mentioned last time, we need this application. But along with that, if we keep mentally in contact with the higher ideals of spirituality, and intellectually if we can remind ourselves of the transitoriness of whatever we may achieve through work and efficiency, it gives us a higher wisdom, a discerning mind. So you may work hard, still if your result is not up to the expectation, you won't be psychologically broken, you won't be mentally broken. You will have the mental strength, mental health to withstand the shock of failure or depression or disappointment. Not that whatever we do will produce the expected result. Very often our work may fail to produce the expected results. It's possible. That is inevitable. But we will be able to withstand the shock of failure. In fact, that is the real benefit of Karma Yoga. We become psychologically and mentally equipped and psychologically strengthened enough to withstand the shock of failure or underachievement. That is the real benefit of Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga doesn't guarantee 100% success. Whatever we do directly depends upon, the result depends upon what the way we perform our duty and responsibility. And there is no guarantee that you will have 100% result every time you undertake a task. It's not possible. That's not nature of the world. You have ups and downs. They're inevitable, invariable. There is no escape from that reality. But we will be psychologically strong enough to withstand the shock of disappointment or failure. Failure will not break you psychologically. You'll be able to withstand it. See, all the great men in the world who have been practitioners of Karma Yoga ideal, they had to encounter failures, setbacks. But the only difference between common people and the great practitioners of Karma Yoga, the Karma Yogis, is this. The Karma Yogis are able to withstand the shock of failures. They were not swept off their feet by setbacks. Common people get psychologically broken by failures. So that's the only difference. I hope it's clear.
Yeah, so basically you have to perform at all levels and use the upper level for resiliency to go through these other lower levels,
yes,
of performance.
That's true.
So it gives you a little bit more resiliency, a little bit more energy to do that. But then when you are at that material level, at the non-karma yoga level, which is the day-to-day life, for example, when Lord Krishna goes in to give the Gita to Arjuna, he doesn't want to go fight, but then tells him he has to fight. So that is also non-ahimsa, because he doesn't touch him to take care of that. So it's kind of a blended situation on both. I mean,
that is true.
You have to protect yourself at that level, you know, as human beings we have to do that. So there has to be protection, and protection is not necessarily, you know, You said that you do it, but without hatred, right?
Yes, yes. Even, people like Krishna, people like Buddha, Christ or Gandhi, look at their history, their life. They have done so much of work and they had setbacks. But the setbacks did not crush them. Because a problem is a very big problem for you when you are not mentally prepared for it. When you are under the wrong notion that there will be no problem, life in this world will be a bed of roses without any problem, then you have to face a problem, then it becomes a terrible dilemma for you. But the moment you understand the world is relative, nothing in this world can be permanent, it is in the nature of the world to have failures and also setbacks. Once we understand this fact, and through intense contemplation understand this reality, then setbacks and failures will not crush you. That is the real, that is yoga. In fact, that is yoga. That latter part is yoga, with something which psychologically and culturally strengthens you. It is an armor that you can wear against shocks and failures and setbacks. Karma yogis also fail in their work. It has happened. Nobody who lived in the world had 100% success every time. The difference between common people and karma yogis is this. Common people very often got completely disillusioned when they had some setbacks and failures. But great karma yogis, spiritual personalities, were not crushed because they realized that it is in the nature of the world to present both success and also failures. Second point is, you consider a problem as something insurmountable when you are not prepared for it. But when you are prepared for it, that problem is not such a big problem. Because we become stronger, so the intensity of the problem is reduced. When you are not prepared, when you are weak spiritually, the problem is insurmountable. It is a big, very big crisis. But when you are psychologically strengthened by the karma yoga ideal, then problem appears to be a lesser problem because its intensity, its intensity is reduced because you become strengthened, so the problem is a lesser one. I hope it's clear.
Got it, Tom. Thank you. Yes.
Any?
Now, as Swami spoke of achievement, attainment, science, technology, in this very sort of kingly realm, right? That it would seem that one would have to realize that by first-hand experience before one could understand the limitation of it, because it comes with a limitation. Is that correct? Am I understood correctly?
Yes.
Now we live in a world where some have reach that limitation because they've experienced enough of that other, but a great many others haven't gotten to that level yet because they haven't experienced attainment, achievement, science, and technology. So you have this imbalance here. You talk of one society, perhaps more like this one, where these things have been attained, but recognize many other places, many other people in the world have not got there yet. So, is there something you
could
say about that?
Well, you may say a highly affluent society may be able to realize the limitations of affluence and material gains.
Because they've already obtained some of that.
Yes, but it doesn't always happen, in fact.
No.
It doesn't always happen. Because more affluence makes people work for still more affluence. It happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't really happen, you know, because greed is insatiable. It continues to grow. He can never completely satisfy a very greedy person. He may be a billionaire, but he wants to be a greater billionaire. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you find people who are, or societies who are not very affluent, but fully aware of the limitations of affluence. So, their karma yoga takes you to the realm of love, rebirth, and love karma. So, I shall give an outline of this. I explained this at the beginning. In Vedanta, we believe in cyclic existence, not in straight line existence. So, if somebody shows the wisdom to understand the limitations of material gains and takes a great interest in spiritual values and shows a great awareness of the fundamental spiritual ideas, it means that person must have experienced some spiritual ideas in previous life. That's what karma yoga. Because he has brought with him in his mind tendencies and impressions, what we call vasanas, which he accumulated in his previous life. What we see or the present life is only a tip of the iceberg. Only a small fraction of the iceberg is visible above the water level. The rest of the iceberg is hidden within. So very often the tendencies and impressions and the characteristics of a person which he displays, which cannot be explained in terms of his experiences in this life, come from a previous existence. So that is why in the classical text, the teachers insist again and again, you may try to practice a little bit of this karma yoga, this yoga, that will help you, that will become a saving factor in your life. See, listening to some of these ideas, reading about these ideas, contemplating on these ideas, even for a fraction of time, in this life, will remain in our spiritual bank. And if not in this life, the next life, when we come in contact with such ideas, suddenly these tendencies come to the surface. They get enriched. They get intensified. That's why people display a great spiritual interest, which we cannot fully explain in terms of their training or their heritage in this life. So, in fact, this question is asked in the Gita sometimes, you know. What happens to those who try to learn? A person who has no way to understand the limitations of material affluence, as you mentioned. But still, if he tries to read a book or listen to some lectures, may not be able to fully understand. Or even if he practices, he fails. What happens to such a person? This question is put by Arjuna to Krishna in the 6th chapter. So Krishna gives the answer. Even a little bit of acquaintance, intellectual acquaintance, a casual acquaintance, half an hour of reading or discussion or listening to these ideas will not be lost. If not in this life, in the next life, these accumulated memories will come to the surface and will drive us towards those channels, and we'll continue from where we have stopped in this life. That is the answer given. So, if you ask the question, where to start? One need not formally start the whole program. Even, in fact, one will be able to withstand these ideas, will be able to appreciate these ideas, only if the person has got some of these tendencies and impressions accumulated in his mind. Otherwise, the very rich people, you tell them about renunciation, they won't listen to you. They may have reached the zenith, the apex of their material influence, the highest level of material prosperity. But it's no guarantee that they will be convinced of the transitoriness or the limitations of material prosperity. It doesn't happen. So, it all depends upon our accumulated characteristics. Because whatever we do, will have its impact on our character. Whatever karma, action that we perform, that we do, will directly have its impact on our character. And our character decides how we act, how we go about doing different things. So, anyone can start at any moment, anywhere. It will not be lost.
So, Swami, as I understand it, the Vedantic idea is that we are born because we still have a certain number of desires. So, there are some material things that I want, and there are some enjoyments I want, some disappointments I wish to avoid, and some unhappiness I wish to avoid. So all those four things may happen in the course of a day. What do you do in the course of a day to counteract those ups and downs that come from attachment?
That means our mind is divided into two compartments. One very positive, with a lot of awareness of spiritual ideas and lot of interest in spiritual matters. On the other hand, lot of desires for material progress and all that. Well, as we go on reading, discussing or contacting these spiritual ideas, the positive part of positive tendencies will get enriched, strengthened. And in proportion to that, the desires also will get weakened. So after all, mind is a combination of tendencies and impressions, you know. So I shall give an example of the subtle body. See, what we normally call this personality, we have got this physical personality. Well, in a family, there may be five children. Five children may display five different characteristics. But from a genetic point of view, they may belong to the same category. From a behavioral point of view, from the standpoint of character, five boys, five girls may belong to five different types. How do you explain this? Sometimes you find fundamental differences. They are given the same education, identical education. They are born and brought up in the same family, same parentage, still totally different in their character and behavior patterns. How do you explain this? They have brought with them in their mind certain accumulated tendencies and impressions from the past. Some of them react to certain situations in a particular, in a given manner. I mean, spiritual ideas may be very attractive for some of them, or may not be so for many others. So it depends upon the accumulated tendencies and impressions. See, in Vedanta, it is very important to understand the concept of human personality in Karma Yoga and Vedanta, called Puri Ashtakam. It's called 8 units. What are we? We are a combination of 8 compartments. 8 compartments. First, the 5 senses. It should be taken as 1 unit. 5 senses of action. Then 5 senses of perception. Another unit. Then the 5 elements which constitute the body. The third. Then the five dimensions of the energy within. 4th one. And then mind, intellect, the sense of ego identity and memory. Fifth, and then the ignorance of our true nature, because we are not aware that we are the Supreme Atman Consciousness. So as a result of this, we have many desires. And because of these desires, we do different actions. We perform different actions. These are the eight units. In a simpler language, I can say mind, intellect, then five senses of action, five senses of perception, and five vital energies, five dimensions of the energy. And you can, there are 17, you can 17 factors. This is subtle body, human character. Now, you may ask the question, this subtle body has got the five senses of action and five senses of perception. But when a person dies, the five senses of action perish naturally. They burnt or they will be electrocuted, they will be buried. They do not remain. But the Vedanta philosophy says, even when you are reborn, the tendencies that you have accumulated through these five senses of action will remain in their subtle form, in residual form, in your mind. We do certain things in a given manner. We can't help it because of certain tendencies and impulses and drives that we have inherited. We can't help it. Now, there is no escape from them. If there are many negative tendencies and impulses, we can only counteract their strength, their force, their power, by accumulating positive tendencies, positive impressions, through positive actions. This is possible. That's how a person can evolve further and further. Now, as we go on evolving, as we go on accumulating positive tendencies, positive memories, we will be weakening the negative ones. So when you get more and more established in Vedantic doctrines, in the higher spiritual ideas, the lower desires, the lower drives, the lower impulses and tendencies and impressions will get proportionately weakened. That's one thing. So the best way is to go on accumulating positive tendencies through positive actions, positive thoughts, and thereby accumulating positive impressions in our mind. Because they constitute the essence of the subtle character that we inherit from life to life. We are not what this body shows in front of you. That is very obvious. You tell the richest person in the world, see, this money can't bring you eternal happiness. He will know, but still he won't listen. He won't come and listen to Vedantic ideals, the ideals of renunciation. He won't be able to psychologically withstand it. He'll run away. You tell the richest man in the world, see, money won't bring you everything. He knows that, but he's experiencing. He may be suffering from anxiety, neurosis, depression, melancholia, everything, eccentricities. And he knows that he is not happy. But instead of turning towards Vedanta or spiritual ideas, he may be turning towards drinks or some other undesirable channels in search of happiness. He is also seeking happiness and freedom, but he is knocking at the wrong doors, that's all. He takes drinks. What for? For freedom. From freedom from himself. His own personality becomes a tyrant, a source of torment for him. So instead of reading the life of Buddha, the life of Jesus Christ, life of Upanishad, I mean the principles of Upanishad, he'll be taking drugs, taking drinks, maybe knocking at many other doors in search of spiritual freedom. Another person may be turning in another direction. Why? Because of the previous some impressions, tendencies that he has accumulated in previous life. That's why Krishna says, even if you do a little bit of spiritual practice, for 1 second, with sincere, that will not be lost. Arjuna asked this question. Arjuna asked a very pathetic question to Krishna. Ayadi Shraddhayo Pedo Yoga Chalida Manasaha Aprapi Yoga Samsiddhim Kangadim Krishna Gachadi. In the sixth chapter, after listening to all the great spiritual ideas from Krishna, Arjuna puts a question. What happens to somebody? Ayati means who has not been able to control his senses. What happens to him who fails and who falls by the wayside? Who fails in everything? Who fails to achieve anything in spiritual life? Don't you think he will be lost? He will be losing this world because he has not worked for material prosperity. And he has not succeeded in gaining spiritual freedom. So he will be losing this world and losing the other spiritual freedom also. Then Krishna says it is not so. Whatever little effort he has made in this life will remain as a source of great relief. And that will drive him in the same direction. And he will be naturally inclined to pursue the same path in the next life. So somebody who has accumulated spiritual tendencies, impressions, he will be passing through the street, if they happen to hear there is some Vedantic conversation or prayer or meditation, he may go there. Another person may be going to the nightclub also, drinking clubs also. So why? Because of the drives and impulses and tendencies that he has accumulated, sure, in this life. It drives him in that direction. So everyone is trying to gain freedom. Some of them are knocking on the wrong doors, that's all. That's all.
And then, could I comment on that?
please.
In terms of people trying to make up or change their previous impressions and tendencies from their karma, how they do that in their present life, are you saying that there's certain people that, because of the past impressions and tendencies, that there's no hope for them to ever get the freedom in that life? Are you saying that that's a possibility, that some people, no matter, you know, what they might try, there's so much, you know, dross or whatever, it's so much stuff from their previous karma that they basically, they do not have a way of doing it.
In fact, I was referring to a question put by Arjuna, the disciple, to his teacher. In fact, the question is this. When Arjuna listened, the disciple, when he listened to the spiritual ideas taught by the master, the disciple asked the question, what happens to those who die before achieving the complete spiritual freedom? They have tried their best, but have not succeeded. And then, what happens to them? So the Krishna's answer is, whatever little effort they have made in this life will become a source of help and strength in their next life. Because the little effort they have made in this life will have made its strong impression in the mind. So those impressions, positive spiritual impressions and tendencies, are very strong in the mind. In their next life, when they happen to come in contact with such ideas, immediately they will be drawn towards those ideas. So we are inheriting a bag of, a mixed bag of positive and also negative tendencies and impressions. There are many positive tendencies and impressions, many negative also. So whatever little good things, good tendencies we have accumulated will remain in our account. They will naturally, in spite of your best efforts to go in the opposite direction, these positive tendencies will drive you to move in the right direction. You may also, one may also be driven to, in the wrong direction also, but the positive tendencies will naturally have their good impact, good effect on our character. That's why, you know, there are certain things that we can't help doing in a given manner. If we think for a long time that I shall do, I shall behave, I shall act in this particular manner tomorrow, we will never be able to do that very often. We can do with a machine, but we can never do that with our own mind. We can do that with a machine, you know. Machine is completely under control. But our own mind is something that we cannot completely predict. And we cannot completely predict its functions.
That metaphor of living on a razor's edge, in the Upanishads,
Yes, that is called Kshurasya Dhara Nishida Dirate. Kathopanishad says, see, razor head, that means the teacher Yama says spiritual path is not an easy path. There he is teaching Nachiketa. But for those who have got a strong sense of discerning mind, it is not difficult. Spirituality is very simple, very natural. But for those who are in the clutches of their senses, who are not aware of the relevance of spiritual ideas, it is not an easy path. So that's what Yama says, the Kathopanishad. So,
can you talk a little bit more about transcendence and what that means?
Excuse me?
What does transcendence mean exactly?
Transcending.
Yeah, how can people transcend?
Oh, yes. Of course, I am talking in the context of Vedanta philosophy, the idea of transcendence. So now, in Vedanta philosophy, the ultimate reality is the immanent principle present in all beings. The same reality is the omnipresent or pervading reality. It is also the transcendental reality. The idea is, if you say that this reality is just the omnipresent reality, it could be mistaken as a kind of pantheistic philosophy. In pantheism, you equate God with nature. But Vedanta goes beyond pantheism. Transcendental actually implies something that's beyond the perception of the mind and the senses of perception. That's the real meaning. Transcendental means something that you cannot perceive with the mind or intellect and the five senses of perception. Something which is not objectified knowledge. That something which we can only experience as our own inner essence. Something which we can realize only and experience through intuitive experience. That's the real meaning. But the Vedanta philosophy also says that it can only be experienced, it cannot be known, as many things are known in this world. It's not an objectified knowledge, it is an experienced reality. So that is the implication of transcending. Transcending the limitations, mind or intellect, and the five senses of perception.
Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om.